Welcome to Word on the Street, a weekly podcast from Barclays where our experts help ordinary investors make sense of the latest news and events impacting the world's financial markets.
Welcome back to Word on the Street. So following our budget special last week, we're going to take a look this week at what's happened in the rearview mirror and also catch up on the latest on the global economy. Lots of news around markets to digest. We'll have a tour of latest thoughts around AI, artificial intelligence, and probably slip in some usual rubbish jibber jabber from myself. Will is not in his gilet this week. But Will, let's start off as usual with the big picture. Has any of our views materially changed on the global economy following everything that's gone on over the past week or so?
Not too materially. I mean, I think people are worrying a little bit about, the sort of inflation beast is kind of raising its ugly head again a little bit, just because people are saying, well, you know, we're getting a couple of positive surprises. Are we right to expect inflation to go back to target? And does that mean something for, you know, our expectations with regards to interest rates and, you know, those kind of things? I'm not sure how much attention to pay to that. It hasn't changed our expectations too much so far. We're watching the space carefully. Yes, and there's some interesting stuff going on in the global economy, really. It's a very interesting
time. I use the word.
It's a very interesting time. Yeah, it is. And I always sort of quite enjoy these moments when the rules and the models are being blown up and all those kind of sureties that people have, all the sort of experts, you know, are suddenly...
It's almost like the textbooks get written up.
Yes, and, yeah. It's good for everyone's humility just to be made to look a complete fool every now and again. I know the feeling well. So it keeps everyone's feet on the ground. Funny enough, I've just come from a lunch full of...
In Liverpool this time.
Well, yeah, so I was breakfast in Liverpool and I had lunch in London.
Covering every blade of the UK.
Covering every blade of the UK. But the lunch was with actually a former MPC member, Monetary Policy Committee for the Bank of England. It was very interesting, the discussion around the table from, you know, economists and all sorts. Just a state of flux, I guess, would be the
key soundbite.
Yes, exactly.
And if we think about the data points specifically, we've got to expand a little bit more on the US inflation print. It always grabs attention.
It does.
Any material takeaways from that piece of data?
No, really. I mean, you know, we've got to remember here and you know, I was discussing with someone last night about this, that, you know, in a way, the kind of setup of the financial services industry and the desire for, you know, free media attention, it kind of biases you to find something to say about the data points, because, you know, the media outlets email you and say, you know, what do you got to say? And if you go back and say
nothing,
you're not going to get any quotes. You're not going to get any, you know, free publicity, free marketing, all that kind of precious oxygen that that we all look for. But I mean, that's probably the truth of it. And just, you know, the reminder here is that, you know, there's huge degrees of measurement error with regards to inflation. So, you know, you just don't want to get carried away with the decimal places. There are some things that we're going to want to continue to watch. You know, I mean, in this series, certainly it was kind of some of the more volatile sub indices that seem to be spiking up. But I don't think it was kind of like completely out of whack with the idea that inflation is going to continue to move on out of the system, and that what we're seeing, I think, is that you saw, you know, a commodity price spike, which is moving painfully through the system slowly. It embeds itself in all sorts of things. You know, if you think about the energy intensive industries like restaurants and catering and so on, you can see how an energy price spike can take a while to
feed through,
to move through. And then you also get this idea that during kind of so-called peacetime in sort of inflation terms, what you find is that supply chains can all become quite unsure of their ability to raise prices. And if you think about price as a lever, it's a very effective profit, profit tool if you can. So in a sense, what you sometimes find, and I think we did find a little bit of this, and this can sometimes explain persistence of inflation, is you get the original price shock and there's some sort of corporate opportunism to a certain extent. Can I get away with it? Pull prices up a little
bit.
Try your luck. And I mean, that's not the sort of universal story, and I don't want to go for this greedflation narrative. It's a, you know, a nice moniker, but I don't think it sort of, you know, quite explains it all. But certainly that can sort of keep things going a little bit longer than they did. But my personal view, and I, you know, I'm going to look foolish in a couple of months saying this, but I do feel now a little bit more comfortable that inflationary pressures are...
I'll write that one down.
Yeah, write it down and play it back to me when we're going back through the next spike. And that does mean that I think, you know, we should find that, you know, yes,
Okay.
I'm going to stop there before I dig myself out of a job.
We spoke a lot about the UK last week for obvious reasons, given the budget, but it'd be remiss of us not to also take a look at the UK employment report a couple of days ago, which seemed to maybe come in a little bit softer than expected. Is that signal or
no? Again, I mean, so we mentioned this last time, you and I, Miles, you know, the labour force survey is still sort of like we're struggling to put too much faith in it for reasons that we explored last time, some of the sort of methodological changes and a number of numbers of participants and so on. So don't get too carried away with that. I mean, what you are seeing though is that the labour force, if you look at sort of some of the extraordinary statistics and realities that arose during the pandemic and after the pandemic, and this is true of several labour markets, but the UK as well, you know, what you found was, you know, a huge surge in job openings, and that created this inflationary pressure to a degree because it created the bargaining power for workers to sort of briefly kind of, you know, jack up wages. And so that was something that people worried about a lot, central bankers worried about a lot. Would that, again, lead to that persistence of inflation that people really worry about? And you found a lot of that has normalized. So I think the sort of job openings to employment has dropped by about a third, you know, amongst the most in the developed world. So your labour market is now looking a lot more normal, let's say, sort of pre-2019, relative to some of the weirdness of the last few years. And most observers will say that that should mean a little bit less pressure on wages going forward. You should find moderating wage growth. Now, that sounds like a bad thing. And I'm not, you know, to be honest, we wouldn't want to go to zero. But this is from a central bank perspective. What they want is wages not running well beyond what an economy can
handle,
essentially. You know, that you need the economy to be able to supply into those wages without creating inflation. So goes the theory anyway. But yes, so, I mean, it feels at the moment there's nothing too, that's not upset the sort of apple cart too much.
Got it. And then just quickly, I know we talk about interest rates every single week. Still on track across the developed world, at least, for cuts in the summer. Consensus seems to suggest around June now, perhaps.
Yes, I mean, that seems to be where people are going for. And interestingly, although I would say we would say that the inflation pictures or the sort of path of inflation in Europe, the UK and the US could be quite different. And they're cutting from slightly different levels relative to what's so-called the neutral rate, you know, the choke point. Yes. June-ish is kind of the thing. I mean, I did hear, you know, again, this the guy we had lunch with, you know, he was suggesting maybe a bit earlier in the UK. I mean, he was expecting. And he's not alone in this, that Europe and UK is going to see faster disinflation than in the US, and that will give the scope to central bankers in those regions to, if not start earlier than the US, perhaps in Europe you could expect more cuts into the end of the year than the kind currently priced on the UK, not so sure, but yes, it's sort of, we're still on target. I mean, like I say, there's plenty of data that could upset that. You know, we've just had this, you know, producer price inflation in the US and the sort of Atlanta wages, and the narrative is kind of live, let's say.
So some will perhaps suggest we're sort of back to that second half of the 1990s comparison, when you've got interest rates going up sharply, the economy doesn't play ball, it wilts a bit under pressure because productivity is starting to pick up, blunting the effect of interest rates. That was a bit of a mouthful, I know, but it does seem to me that this is one of the more prominent debates in markets at the moment. So what are your sort of thoughts around that?
Yes, I mean, you know, Miles, I mean, we're always wary of kind of transposing historical playbooks onto the moment.
Assuming it's simply going to happen again.
Yeah, and I think, you know, my harping on about history is always more about the differences rather than the similarities to a degree, because we always want to be very careful about just how different the economy is from now to then. I mean, there are aspects that are similar, and I think, you know, the thing that we've pointed out that I think is quite interesting in this context is that then, like you say, you had a sharp interest rate rising cycle, which actually was a butterfly flapping its wings, creating a tornado over in emerging markets. That was the Asian financial crisis, you know, LTCM and all that kind of thing. And the main thing that sort of helped the economy, the US economy, blunt that interest was the advent of this new productivity paradigm. So then it was kind of, you know, internet-ish stuff. And productivity jumped between 1995 and 2005. And that sort of meant the economy really accelerated. Now, the really interesting thing about it, I think, was that most of the experts of the time were saying, like, there's no productivity growth. We can't see it. It's not showing up in the data. There's no real reason to believe in it. But actually, the central bank, the Fed chair of the time, Alan Greenspan, who was known for a sort of, you know, his reliance not just on the numbers, but on the qualitative underlying aspect and the economy, so to speak. And he made a what's now remembered as a great call not to tighten interest rates as unemployment got very low, because he believed productivity was picking up, even though the data wasn't telling him so. Now, that productivity pickup only became visible in the data, I think, in 1998 Q3. Several years later,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, it takes time.
Yeah, it can take time. Now, you know, could it be the same this time? I mean, you can make lots of arguments about this. I mean, and in a way, you know, you are seeing productivity pick up in the US. It might not be associated with AI, somewhat weirdly. That may still be to come, in a sense, because people are still really in the experimentation phase with AI. But you are seeing some other aspects which are potentially pushing it up. So yes, it's interesting. And people are pointing out on the negative side that you're not yet seeing the sort of capital expenditure from companies on technology as such that you want to see in order to really believe in this. But yes, I think there are some interesting similarities just to bear in mind with regards to how you would handicap a melt-up, essentially, you know, a bullish case for the economy. May even end in a kind of 99-2000 if you carry on, but that's what, you know, that's a little bit what people are worried about, isn't it, I guess? But
yeah.
We're not there yet, I don't think, but okay. Certainly, yes, there's some quite lofty expectations.
And you referenced AI, perhaps that feeds into lofty expectations based on what some people are saying, but again, it's something that more and more clients just seem to be constantly referencing, and understandably so. It really is the kind of the topic of the moment, isn't it? Mm. Are we starting now to get a sense of just how quickly this new technological leap forward could drive things further? Everything seems to be moving very quickly. There are potential benefits, but I suppose there are risks as well.
You're right on all of that. And I've been lucky enough to do a few...
You've been talking a lot about it.
Well, so I've been talking and listening a lot about it. Because I obviously, you know, do the kind of usual jibber-jabber about history, vague stuff, you know, not related. I'm not a computer scientist.
But AI isn't in history.
Yes, I know. And as I'm regularly told, and my wife was laughing at me that I was on a panel discussing technology when, yes, I mean, seeing me wrestle with my TV the other day, you'd know that this is not my area of specialty, but in a way, so I've been lucky enough to be on a couple of panels with, you know, genuine experts, sort of computer scientists and entrepreneurs who really are experimenting with this technology. And I think what you can say is that, you know, it's not the finished article by a long shot. Things, you know, you are seeing very rapid improvements, you know, almost week to week in terms of what's being released. The things that people still worry about, I guess, is the kind of degree of hallucination. You know, how much can I trust what I get out of these large language models? And the hallucination seems to be quite a persistent feature. Someone joked that they're like dads. They tell bad jokes and they're not ashamed to speak rubbish when they don't know the answer. So that's kind of a little bit that. But still, these are kind of formidable pattern spotters. And the interesting thing to your point, I think, is that the pure kind of simultaneity about it, you know, there's never been a technological breakthrough where the whole world finds out about it at once. And then suddenly there's this kind of global, very public race. You know, you can think about all of the breakthroughs in the past that's been quite sort of seeped into society a little bit. But this is different. Yeah, this is different. And it does... There is something real in here. People are very excited about it. I too am sort of wary of the idea that, you know, it's not our first tech miracle, is it? You know, they don't always go the way
they don't
you
always.
Expect. No, they don't always go the way you expect them to. But certainly, yeah, you're starting to see tangible application, I think.
I've certainly noticed it more and more on, I don't know, you go onto a website, maybe your phone network to sort out a bill or something, and what was once live chat powered by a human, they are all seemingly now just, you know, powered by AI chatbots, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, and the thing to, I think about with the march is, you know, that it's not going to be across all sectors at once. And I think, you know, the urging that, you know, I heard and have given myself is that, as with all kind of technological breakthroughs, it's about experimentation on the part of the corporate sector. Because often the big productivity gains come from when you take this new technology and you change your processes, your the organization of your business around it. And again, we go back to that kind of, you know, the electrification of the US economy. It took, you know, the productivity gains showed up slowly, surprisingly so, because what it meant, the first, you know, set of factory owners, they just substituted one power source for another, steam mostly, and then, you know, into electricity. It took the next generation of factory owners who'd been immersed in this general purpose technology from birth to reorganize the factory processes around this more flexible, safer power source. And that was when the productivity gains were unlocked. So you can find it's kind of staggered. But the other thing that's going on at the moment, which I think is sort of, you've got potential kind of massive revolutions going on and not totally unlinked, but, you know, generative AI, biotech, and energy as well. You know, so solar and battery tech. And these are really important advances that could all be coming together at once. Now, that is A, potentially incredibly chaotic for the global workforce and society and all those kind of things. But for investors, it's, again, this is self-serving, but it's, I really believe quite strongly that it's worth having that call option on future human productivity growth at the moment, because it feels like humans are about to get a big productivity uplift in the next couple of years.
It's a fascinating space.
It is. Yeah, no, it is. It's changing fast. So, yeah.
And I suppose we'll just have to see, as always. We will. Time will tell.
Yeah, and I think, Miles, you know, the warning from us is always, you know, is not to use the recent past or mine the recent past too hard for what's coming in the future, because that recent past may not provide a very good template for what's coming, to be honest, especially not if these technologies are coming through. And that recent past, which is shock-strewn stagnation, can't say where shocks are coming or when, but beware of just focusing on the potential for negative shocks, because the potential for positive shocks really could upend.
And not just those big names that everyone reads about. It could trickle through, couldn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, there is concern that this would exacerbate the kind of winner-take-all story that's been in the economy for a while. And, you know, those things like, think about Google's or various internet, you know, think about search and the network effects. You know, the more people you have using your search, the better your algorithm can get, and therefore the more people, you know, so you get these kind of network effects which weren't really very present in previous economies. And you think about, you know, for instance, manufacturing shoes, it's quite hard to own the whole market, isn't it? Whereas now the nature of some of these industries and the nature of the global economy has meant that you're sort of getting these kind of winner-take-all markets. Now, do these technologies kind of exacerbate or, you know, that effect? Unknown. But my hunch is not to be too prescriptive about it in a way, because that's not the way that past technologies have necessarily moved. They've moved in quite mysterious ways. And this one could have, you know, significant democratizing effect. And you're seeing that in some small companies having success with some of the sort of smaller language models trained on very specific sets of data, and how that is boosting productivity. So, you know, firm level productivity. So yes, our urging as usual is to sort of, you know, keep an open mind as to who the winners are. They're often not. Think about Cisco and the internet one. And think actually, you know, think about Google actually, in truth. You know, Google was only born in 1998, you know, so we didn't really participate in that boom around the turn of the millennium. And that was ultimately the winner in this space. Obviously, none of these are stock recommendations.
So and while we're on the big names, we've got a reference to TikTok. It's been getting a lot of attention as well. Quick comments there?
Yes, again, really interesting. I mean, again, I would use TikTok to sort of symbolize the wider social media setting and some of the things of the modern era. I mean, some people are comparing it sort of, you know, they're sort of saying this is kind of China's revenge for the opium wars, you know, when the UK turned around and sort of, you know, spent some time smuggling, or I should say British trading firms spent time smuggling Indian opium into China in exchange for silver so that they could buy Indian tea to square the triangle. And then they started doing it forcibly. And so, you know, yes, we don't have much more moral authority on that point. But yes, so this is kind of, you know, this is the modern version of it, isn't it? It's a kind of... yes, it's a social media crack, it would appear, and it is certainly coming in for some debate. And I think it highlights some of the sort of some of the big topics of the moment, which is kind of, you know, what degree of transparency and trust do we require? But more broadly as well, I think, you know, I think it does, you know, like other social media, and we were talking about this a lot with clients up in Liverpool and Milton Keynes this week, was just an awareness of how these algorithms have, we have sort of, in a sense, forced them to feed us what we love, which is outrage and disgust and all of those kind of things. And an awareness of that is probably important, because these are not unbiased news feeds in a way. They are perfectly tailored and increasingly surgically tailored to feed us that kind of that diet. So, yes, just be careful, I think.
We're a funny race, aren't we, the human race?
We are.
It's like what we always say about markets. You know, yes. You might see stock markets fall 2% and it's stock markets crash, but they haven't really, have
yes,
they?
No, just... no, we do. We definitely, and you know this from, you know, our behavioural guys always tell us that losses loom larger than gains for our clients. You know, that's very true for investors. And the same is true, I think, in our, you know, in our private lives to a degree. You know, we're very still focused, you know, the evolutionary story. We haven't really got rid of that kind of that fear, which is important. It kept us top of the tree, didn't it? It's not necessarily...
It's really interesting.
Yes.
I'm going to be the bad guy. You've yes. given some positive reasons to be optimistic about the future, but yes. equally some of the research reports I'm reading are sort of suggesting, well, they're giving a more sceptical view of artificial intelligence, and some at the same time are suggesting that maybe we're getting near late cycles. So perhaps at that point where we might see, you know, economic growth start to fall, maybe go negative, we might see a stock market wobble. Mm-hmm. Where do you sit? Is some of that fair, or is that a little bit too negative?
I'll give my view, and there's a variety of views on the team, but they're not on the podcast, so they don't get to speak today, but we can get them back and hear their views, certainly.
But they're a good check and balance team, aren't they?
They're always, yes, always. But no, I mean, Miles, I don't really believe in this kind of analysis at all. In truth, the way it's derived is people sort of, you know, it's a kind of stylized view of the economic cycle, where what you get is you start off and, you know, animal spirits are low and you start getting rising unemployment and people start investing. And then ultimately, you know, you get into a stage where lots of job adverts are in the shop window.
Everything looks rosy.
Everything looks rosy. And then
everyone's happy.
Yeah, people get overinvested. And then the sort of, you know, what you tend to find is the industrial cycle ultimately turns because central bankers start getting unnerved about the inflationary heat. They kill the cycle. Everything goes down and you start from the beginning again. Now,
some even used to call it like a 5-year cycle.
Yeah, yeah, and it was, you know, like, so I think the numbers were, I was just looking in my notes because I'm sure I wrote down, like, there was an incredible story about how this has happened. So, like, if you look so from in the National Bureau of Economic Research, from the late 1950s to the early 1980s, the US economy had 30 separate recessions lasting an average of 18 months, and expansions lasted an average of 33 months. However, since then, what you found is that because of all sorts of things, so the growth of the services sector, meaning that sort of manufacturing was minimized, globalization, and generally the economy has just become less prone to inflationary shocks. So you found that actually there, since the 1980s, there are just 4 recessions lasting 9 months, and the expansions have averaged 104 months each, and the current one is now 47 months. And so in a sense, the new economy that we live in, services tend to be less interest rate sensitive anyway. And there's lots of mitigants to higher interest rates, as we're finding in this current economic cycle, you know, not just the fact that, you know, the way people borrow and how people borrow, but I'm not sure those kind of old stylized kind of views of the economic cycle mean that much. And they're based on kind of things like, you know, how tight a high yield spread, so how much over, you know,
how much extra return
you get from, you know, lending to a junky company. They're no longer so junky anymore, the quality's gone up, but you know what I mean. And, you know, equity valuations and sort of various other things, but I'm not sure how meaningful that is, and particularly not at the moment. I mean, we're still dealing with the huge distortions of the pandemic. I can't emphasize how much that is still distorting our view of, you know, the underlying trends in the global economy. that alongside the potential kind of, you know, change in technological context, as well as this huge change in US policymaking, the presence of China. There is so much that is different now. You want to be very wary of historical comparisons.
It's just fascinating you say that, because it's just brought me back to just at the start of the pandemic, where everyone was talking around transitory.
Yes.
It didn't quite work out that way.
Well, it's sort of, yeah, I mean, not quite. You're right. But it wasn't, in a way, there is still a way of saying that was right. So there are
It comes back to timescales.
Yes, exactly. And there's a few now. I mean, Janet Yellen was saying, actually, I apologize for the use of transitory. But there was another very famous, Claudia Sam, who's a ex-central banker. She's saying, I don't. I'm very, you know, transitory is right. So, you know, there's still this kind of debate about, is what we saw, have central bankers actually stopped inflation in its tracks? Or was this something that just would have passed anyway because it was an energy shock running through the system?
You could debate it for weeks, couldn't you?
You could, and no one would stay awake.
I didn't want to say that. Very good. We'll wrap it up there.
Good.
We probably hit time. Yes. And thanks for that. And we'll speak again next week. Have a fantastic weekend.
Thank you, Miles.
All investments can fall as well as rise in value, and their past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. This podcast is not a personal investment recommendation.